Okay, thank you. We have on the call Eric Dierker, Adam Scoville, Steve Del Bianco, Chris Gibson, Carol Bird, and myself, Steve Metallitz, and we have Glenda Saint-Gerie and Maria Farrell from the ICANN staff. Is there anybody whose name I didn't call? Okay, well, as Glenn mentioned, this is our last call as a subgroup. I believe the full group meets next Wednesday, a week from today, and I'm not sure if the time for that has been finalized.
As far as I know, Steve, it is the same time as the previous call, which is 13:30 UTC.
Okay, thank you. And I'm sure we'll be getting a notice with the call-in number and so on. Anyway, what...
Can I just ask, is that an hour and a half earlier than this call?
Yes. On our last call, we had discussed a discussion outline, which I had circulated, and I sent out last Wednesday evening kind of a revised version of that, making a few changes that seemed to reflect the discussion that we had had. Feeling we did not really get to the last page of that outline, and the feeling on the call was that we should focus on that on this final call, which is the enforcement aspects and the how question, how would it be enforced? But let me first open the floor if people have any questions or comments on the revisions to the outline that were made since the last call. Okay. Well, then what I would suggest that we do is that we turn to the how questions, and then at the end of that discussion, let's kind of see where we are in terms of what will be reported forward to the full group. So let's turn to the how questions. What is in the outline on this last page is really four categories of defaults, four categories of circumstances in which the system is not working as it should be, and it's really just to identify those and open up a discussion of how what would happen in those circumstances. The first one really has to do, it's kind of in the interface between this group and subgroup C. If, as I understand, subgroup C had been discussing, if the OPOC model only applied to natural persons registering for non-commercial purposes, and if somebody who didn't meet that category, meet those criteria and designated an OPOC, then you would need some mechanism for dealing with that. The second would be if there's a WHO violation, in other words, the OPOC lacks some of the capabilities that it's supposed to have. But the third would be another, as we subdivided the WHO question, if OPOC lacks some of the relationships it's supposed to have. For example, if we were to require accreditation and weren't accredited, that's actually probably a fairly easy one in that spectrum. And the fourth is if the OPOC fails to perform its tasks, if it fails to perform them at all, which is the what issues, or if it fails to perform them in a timely manner. I think we generally agreed we would defer discussion of what exactly would be a timely manner, but we obviously identified some issues there.
And Steve, this is Steve Del Bianco. By defer discussion, do you mean until next Wednesday's meeting? Do you want to resolve that today, or is it going to be deferred sort of indefinitely?
Well, I think if we get through how, we can turn to when.
Okay.
A little bit. But there was some feeling that this is kind of at the implementation level, and if it was, you know, if there was some general agreement, we wouldn't necessarily have to say this has to be done in 1 hour and this has to be done in 1 day or whatever.
Well, brings a more general question. What do you have in mind as our deliverable to the full working group, so full task force by next Wednesday? Is it this document with how much more meat on the bones?
Well, I'm assuming it is something like this document, and I guess one question is what can I preface it with? Can I say that this is, you know, to use the terminology that I think we were asked to use, the whole working group was asked to use at the end of its process, can we say whether there's agreement or support or an alternate view regarding some of these issues? You know, I'm a little hesitant to say that because we really haven't had a very active list and we haven't had a huge turnout on our calls, but maybe at the end of the discussion today we can turn to whether we can say in the preface, what degree of support or endorsement or whatever the right word is are we sending this thing forward. I should add that all of the, both of the detailed proposals that were put forward, yours and Chris Gibson's, would also be attached to this. I think that's the standard protocol.
But at least in the case of my proposal, I feel as if it's evolved in this one.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't necessarily want to throw it in the mix to create confusion about where we are in the consensus.
Okay.
I'm happy to have this be one document as far as I'm concerned, but I did wonder about how adding more detail. The documents that a couple of us had submitted as plans contained
more detail.
Excruciating detail about what to do in terms of penalizing a OPOC and so on and what the registrar needed to do. And if we add that back in, I know we definitely create controversy, but I was curious about how detailed you wanted our submission to be versus raising questions.
Well, I think we can... You can try to boil it down into a simplified form, but I think we should attach both proposals, and we could point out that some of it may have been, overtaken by events and further discussion. But I think a lot of the detail comes in the how area, and I know at least in Chris's proposal, there's a lot of detail about under what circumstances the registrar would step in, I believe that's also a feature of your proposal.
Yeah.
So maybe we should just turn to that now, and I've put that down as the fifth question under how, which is, what role would the registrar have if the OPOC fails to step forward? And I suppose one answer could be doing all the things that the OPOC is supposed to do. But let me ask either Steve or Chris to kind of sketch out how they see the enforcement mechanism for these defaults. First, have we left out any major areas of default, major failures that the OPOC might encounter, might commit, if you will, and what do you see as the main enforcement mechanisms?
This is Steve. I might suggest that the OPOC's responsibilities, they might evolve from initially relay, and if relay was unsatisfactory, then going to reveal and then potentially to remedy. So one of the aspects of our conversation would be what is it the OPOC has to do in an escalating or varied sense of responsibilities? And then if you get to the bottom line and say that the OPOC has failed on one or all of its responsibilities, as a general matter, I thought we were then turning to the registrar and to some extent the registry, since they were under contractual relationships with ICANN and had a much better opportunity to have them take action. So we sort of take things out of the OPOC's hands, given that the OPOC has failed to uphold their responsibilities. So that's sort of a philosophical approach that says that we're not going to mess with trying to track down and take legal steps with an OPOC when we in fact have mechanisms available to go to the registrar, and in one case the registry. How do you feel about that approach?
Well, let me just make two responses to that. One, we've talked about this, whether this is kind of an escalating set of steps that the OPOC is supposed to take, or whether there are some cases where they would go right to one of the further steps. In other words, there would be some cases in which they would have to reveal immediately without having relayed.
I'm fine with that, by the way. We just describe which cases those are.
Okay. The second is, right now, registrars don't have these responsibilities. For example, let's take a simple case where it's just a relay. you know, there's no obligation to reveal necessarily, but you, the requester just wants to be able to get in touch and communicate a message to the actual registrant. Right now, the registrar really has no responsibility in that regard. I mean, if they're operating a proxy service, maybe, but let's assume not. If I send in an email to register.com and said I want to contact a particular registrant, obviously that might, you know, maybe the who is data is insufficient for me to contact them. Right now the registrar wouldn't have any responsibility to do anything with that. So are we loading a new responsibility onto the registrar in this area, and particularly when it comes to you know, a reveal or a remedy situation? Is this a responsibility that we want that could be is to be imposed on the registrar in this circumstance?
This is Eric. I don't see the need to increase the registrar's responsibilities. I don't think that's what we are really tasked to do. It seems to me to be outside the purview to switch now from what the OPOC responsibilities are to now what the registrar's responsibilities are. It seems to me that's something where probably within the RIAA, but I don't think it seems to me beyond, and I don't want to use the term beyond the scope. I don't mean that we're treading on wrong territory. I just simply, if we're going to come out with a approach, I don't think we are mandated to suggest what registrars should do.
Steve, can I get in the queue? This is Adam.
Yeah, Adam, anybody else want to get in the queue at this point?
Yeah, this is Chris.
Okay, Adam, Chris, anybody else? Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, you know, I think that our mandate is to talk about stuff like this because it's to talk about both the responsibilities of the OPOC and the enforceability. What happens if the OPOC doesn't fulfill its responsibilities? And that, I think, you know, there's got to be someone who enforces those obligations or who takes action on the penalties. And insofar as through all of ICANN's framework in terms of imposing obligations down to the registrant level, it all goes through the registrar. And, you know, so there's no way, you have to be talking about what the registrar does. And you know, if this is sort of an alternative to the registrar's obligation of publishing the, or existing obligation of publishing who the registrant is in the who is, then, you know, they are the natural place for natural party to possibly shut off the OPOC as the contact in the case where the OPOC's not doing its job. I mean, that seems to me to be the most basic level of what would happen. I mean, there's questions about whether there should be more that happens, but if the OPOC is just a roadblock and is just not doing its job of passing on communications and so forth, then you got to get rid of the OPOC. And who's going to do that? Well, the party that puts the information in the WHOIS database in the first place, and that's the registrar. Well,
or why not the pseudo-regulator, ICANN?
Because as I understand, ICANN doesn't have direct access to the who is.
They have contractual access, so that wouldn't be an issue. But it would be ICANN who's doing the response to a failure of the.
Okay. Let's can we get back in the queue, Chris?
Yeah, I wanted to echo, I think, first Adam's point. I believe it's important that we don't look at the role of the OPOC in a vacuum, and that you do have to consider questions, as you put it in option 5, Steve. If there's a default on the part of the OPOC, what's the role of the registrar? And I think, you know, going back to the first page of your document, you have to think in terms of any potential role for the registrar in relation to relay, in relation to reveal, and, of course, in relation to remedy. And working with your document, Steve, I had some small changes to the language at the very first page. All of those three obviously relate to the how question that we're talking about now. Secondly, one thing that I think Eric just said reminded me of something that I had put in my detailed draft, which is if he's suggesting that ICANN has a more active role, I do believe that, you know, one thing that might have to be highlighted is you need adequate resources for, on the part of ICANN, in enforcing the role of the OPAC or of the registrar or of both, because it will be the case that certain OPACs, whether they fall in one of the three categories that Steve has previously mentioned, or perhaps certain registrars are not fulfilling these roles. And I'm today, for example, dealing with a matter where we're writing a letter to the General Counsel of ICANN because a particular registrar is not following through on certain matters, and you have a sense that those resources aren't adequately staffed. So I, for one, think it should stay, at least initially, at the level of the OPAC, and then if the OPAC is in default, then the registrar, before things are escalated to ICANN. But if they are escalated to ICANN, they have to be adequately resourced at that level, too.
Okay, anybody else to the queue?
Steve Del Bianco.
Steve, anybody else? Go ahead, Steve.
Following up on the previous comment, when we escalate to ICANN, I would suggest that it's a general matter, and that anytime we escalate to ICANN, it's because ICANN needs to enforce the responsibilities of the contractual parties, like registrars and registries. It needs to enforce the consensus policies and the contracts it has with those parties. So that escalation is a general escalation, and it's not just with respect to who is and to OPAC, but almost anything that a registrar and a registry is doing. So if we couch a request for ICANN to add staff necessary to police its contractual parties, I think that can be sold better as a general matter for all matters that ICANN needs to get its contractual parties to do what they're supposed to be doing. In other words, it doesn't need to be a special set of resources at ICANN just looking after the OPAC.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess there are two ways to look at this. One is that it's the default would be the registrar, and then if the registrar doesn't do those things, then ICANN would be asked to enforce its contractual agreement with the registrar. The other is, which I think is what Eric may be suggesting, is that you would go to ICANN when you have a problem here. You wouldn't necessarily go to the registrar. But go to ICANN directly. It would have some.
Excuse me, Robin Gross now joins.
It would have some responsibility to act.
This is Chris.
Yeah, Chris, go ahead.
Just on that point, I think, you know, the comment is well taken that, you know, if you were going to include something on this point in a preface to this document or something, you'd just highlight that for purposes of the OPAC, you know, but more broadly as well, you know, in order to enforce contractual responsibilities, general and as well, and is in relation to the role of the registrars, which may require an amended RAA and the OPAC. You know, ICANN should have proper resources, but I'm not suggesting that it wouldn't be broad, that it would be any broader than what would be defined through the contractual chain for the various actors.
Okay. Well, let me get back to this question of what the registrar could do in these circumstances. If you have a, obviously, I think this is what Adam was saying, that obviously the registrar would be in a position to reveal. The registrar has the data on the admin and tech contacts and the rest of the data on the registrant contact that has not been, would not be made available to the public. And it would be in a position to substitute those if there were a default by the OPAC. So it has that capability. What are the I guess the one question is, what are the circumstances under which it should do that? And the second is, what about a situation, you know, a relay type situation where, you know, may not go as far as making the information public, but simply passing it. Passing a message on to the registrant. I would ask Adam, and you gave that as an example, I think, of what a registrar could do. Is that the remedy, is that the enforcement mechanism we should be looking at in all cases?
Well, you know, I guess thinking more about Eric's comment, I mean, well, first of all, I think that you know, if we could get ICANN to have enough resources to do this kind of enforcement, you know, ICANN might be a more impartial actor than the registrars, but I'm not sure whether ICANN wants to set up that kind of infrastructure to handle those kinds of complaints. I mean, who knows? Maybe ICANN does. After all, it sets up the Who Is Data Problem Report and all sorts of stuff like that. But you know, it seems like to some degree, if you looked first to ICANN, all ICANN would do would be to go back to the registrar and say, do this. Swap out the name of the actual registrant that you have for the name of the OPOC. It would basically be ICANN making the decision, but the registrar is still implementing it. At least on the reveal side. In terms of other aspects, in terms of the relay side, if we set up the registrar as a whole other relay, I guess this is just my sort of initial reaction, then that kind of is duplicative and defeats the purpose of an OPOC. If you know you have the OPOC and they relay, but then if they don't do what they're supposed to do, the registrar relays. You know, that's a duplicative infrastructure, and it's not really necessary to have the registrars involved at that level. I would say I know that others have raised questions about whether if the OPOC's not doing what it should do, whether there are other actions in terms of removing the name from the DNS or putting it on whatever sort of hold status. Those might be things that would be within the registrar's technical abilities to do, and it might make sense. You know, again, we have to watch for the sake of the registrants, those kind of sanctions in terms of the register fly type situation where, you know, obviously in a lot of cases we're concerned with what if the registrant is doing something bad with their domain, but the other situation of what if the registrant is just fine and the OPOC is, you know, about to go insolvent or is a bad actor or something, the registrar fly type situation, we don't want the registrant necessarily to lose its domain name because the OPOC is a bad actor. But that's a realm that's worth talking about.
Okay, so you're breaking this down, you know, about in terms of our relay, reveal, and remedy. In the relay situation, you're concerned that would be duplicative. Reveal is a situation, I suppose, where I mean, the registrar certainly could do that. And I guess we're talking here not about necessarily making it public, but revealing to the requester the full contact data.
Yes.
And then remedy, I think, Adam, you're raising the point that has been raised before, which is that we have to be very careful about the circumstances in which someone would be empowered to, you know, put a registration on hold, because there certainly is a real possibility of abuse in that situation.
Can I get in the queue? This is Steve.
Yeah, Steve. Anybody else in the queue? Go ahead, Steve.
I think you try to put a restatement on, Adam, that I would concur with, and that let's deal with just relay and reveal right now. And if an OPOC fails to relay or reveal within the time frame we provided, I do believe that those two should result in the registrar revealing the registered name holder to the complainant, not to the general public. And I agree that with Eric that we should not task the registrar with another round of relays, but rather something that's simple and straightforward that they can do, revealing the registered name holder to the complainant, because the complainant can document that the OPOC has failed to carry through the relays, and it's a round trip on a relay that's necessary. It's not simply a one-way relay to the RNH. We have to get information relayed back to the complainant from the RNH, and if you don't, then that relay has failed. And the failure of a relay or the failure of a reveal, I believe, should cause the registrar to reveal to the complainant the RNH.
This is Eric. That certainly sounds very reasonable to me.
Okay.
All right.
If we can get consensus on that, Steve, then we can deal with the much more controversial question of remedies.
Okay, further comments on Steve's proposal, which is if the OPOC fails to relay or reveal, then the registrar would reveal to the requester, not to the general public. And the relay function is a round-trip function. So let's just figure out how this would work in practice. I make a request. I send a legal request to the OPOC, and I don't hear anything after a certain period of time. Do I then go to – now, we don't know whether that was because it was not relayed or to the registered name holder, or because the registered name holder – it was relayed to the registered name holder, and the registered name holder just chose to ignore it or just decided not to answer it. Should the outcome be the same in both those circumstances? I guess from the perspective of the requester, you can't necessarily tell which is which. You don't know.
Unless there's an audit function and the OPOC sends some sort of confirmation back to the requester that it has in fact fulfilled its responsibility and sent the stuff on.
Okay. And yet, if the complainant is not at this point then having a interaction with the RNH, either through relays or a reveal, then the OPOC role has failed. Not that the OPOC person did anything wrong, but the role of OPOC has failed. If a complainant is unable to communicate and seek answers from the RNH.
This is Eric. I think we need to always keep in mind that the other word that was used for this position is proxy, and the proxy simply stands in the stead of something else. And so I think it should be a fairly automatic, and I like the term failed. That's a good way to phrase it. For who cares what reason, he went hiking in the canyon for 2 weeks and he missed his call. Whatever reason, it failed, so it gets relayed both round trip by the registrar fairly immediately. And since we're kind of avoiding timelines here, but I'm thinking like 48 hours to 5 days.
Okay. So is there general agreement that if in a relay situation, if the requester doesn't hear anything back, this kind of gets into Steve's escalation approach. Again, I make a request. It's a relay request. I don't hear anything back. So the relay has failed in that sense. Do I then go to the OPOC and ask him to reveal, or do I go straight to the registrar and ask him to reveal?
This is Stephen. I'd recommend give the OPOC a chance to do their job before imposing on the registrar responsibilities that have been delegated to the OPOC.
Okay, and then if I say, there's been no effective relay, now it's time to reveal, and the OPOC doesn't do that, then presumably you would go to the registrar for that.
Well, this is Chris, and I know we're down at the detail level. I two comments. One, I like the idea that, for example, if there was an accreditation requirement of some form, you'd have OPOCs would be required to confirm that they received requests, so you'd know they received it. That would be one. Second, I mentioned in my proposal, for example, that copies should be sent to registrars, and part of the reason for that is you could, by having them copied on the initial communication sent to the OPOC, you'd be able to tell them, okay, it's been whatever period of time and we have not heard back. Then you'd be able to escalate it by showing the registrar, this period of time has passed, there's been silence on the other end and we now need to come to you. So, but I agree with that last comment that it should be first for the OPOC to perform its responsibilities.
Okay, so maybe we're talking about a somewhat expanded definition of relay. It's not just send it to the registered name holder. It's also kind of a BCC back to the requester and a BCC to the registrar or something like that in order to document that this occurred. Again, I assume that could be done on an automated basis.
I agree. I think that's important.
At least we're talking about an email request here. Obviously, it might be a little different in a non-email request.
Okay. So much of this is Steve Del Bianco. The status quo is that with an accurate and open whois, that a complainant can communicate, can reach a registered name holder. And we're simply trying to give that same capability to the complainant in an OPOC regime, but respecting the role of the OPOC as standing between the complainant and the RNH. So this notion of relay and then escalating to reveal is all meant to simply replace the functionality that's supposed to be there today if WHO is accurate and open.
Okay. All right, so if there were no, if the relay function fails, then the OPOC is supposed to reveal. If the OPOC doesn't reveal, the reveal function fails, and the registrar reveals. Is that kind of the model we're talking about here?
Yes.
I think. Okay. Okay, now what about these remedy cases? I mean, we haven't really fleshed out what would be the remedy cases, but so maybe it's premature to talk about that, and I think Adam has sounded a cautionary note about that on a couple of occasions.
May I make a request? If someone can summarize, what is the status quo responsibility of a registrar if it learns of illegal activity or infringing content on a site? Let's work off of what the status quo is before imposing new obligations.
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure that we know the answer to that. Obviously, the registrar accreditation agreement requires that the registrar have a contract with the registrant that says, I will not use the registered domain name in a manner that infringes the rights of others and so forth. And there may be other terms of service on which the registrar provides the service to the registrant. But
are those terms uniform between all registrars and registrants? Are they dictated by ICANN and the registrar accreditation agreement?
Well, some aspects of them are, yeah.
The aspects that are common and current would be worth repeating in our documents so that it's not seen as if we're raising the bar for legal and ethical responsibility, but simply restating the status quo.
Well, all I'm saying is that there is a requirement that the registrar have an agreement with the registrant that the registrant will not use the domain name for illegal purposes, but the remedy for that or the enforcement for that is quite murky because, you know, there aren't any third-party beneficiaries of that agreement, and I think in practice, obviously, some registrars will probably say if it falls within that category of misuse, they will say, well, go to use the UDRP or to remedy that. That's the method that should be used. I mean, all I'm saying is at this point, I think it would be hard to say that a registrar has an enforceable obligation to put on hold a domain name that's being used for illegal purposes. It's done. It's certainly done on an informal basis, but I'm not sure you could say that they have a formal legal obligation to do that. It might have some. If they fail to do it, it might have some repercussions for their own liability. But I don't think that there is a set protocol that's within the ICANN agreements that says under these circumstances the registrar must make the site go dark or put it on hold or take any action in that regard. I don't think we have any registrars on the call. So I could certainly stand corrected on that, but that's my understanding.
Do the responsibilities of the registrar differ with respect to a intellectual property infringement versus a consumer fraud issue? Are those treated distinctly, or do they both go to UDRP?
No, only certain categories of intellectual property problems can go to the UDRP. I just gave that as an example. If you go to Chris or Adam, you may be able to flesh this out. If you go to a registrar today and say, you know, xyz.net is being used for a range of illegal purposes, it might be a trademark infringement, there might be copyright infringing activity on the site to which that domain name resolves, there might be a fraud situation, a phishing situation, what response are you going to get from a registrar? Number one. And number two, is there a legal obligation for them to, because I think, Steve, what you're driving at is what is their legal obligation right now, and are we increasing it in this proposal?
Steve, you said it exactly right, because rhetorically, when we argue for anything, the firmest ground we can stand on is ground that codifies current obligations rather than increases.
Now, this is Chris. As I see it, registrars normally, and it would be very helpful to have their input, but they have contractual rights, you know, rights to do certain things, but they don't as a matter of, and they might have rights to cancel their registration if there's inaccurate data. They might have other rights, but they normally resist doing so. It's a matter of discretion if they wanted to exercise those, and certainly when it comes to trademark-related issues, they'll simply, you know, say file your complaint under the UDRP. For other issues, you can try to bring pressure on them in respect of things like phishing scams, and they may do something more, but, you know, that's it's not, there's no duty on them to do it. You know, contractually, they may have a clause that says that it's within their powers, but it's a different thing to say they would do it as a matter of course.
Okay. That's certainly consistent with my understanding of where things stand now. Well, so I guess one question is, should that change? Is there some category, you know, where does OPOC make a difference? Bringing in the OPOC, does that make a difference?
This is Chris. I think it highlights the importance that the registrar has to have access to the WHOIS data at a minimum so that they can perform the WHOIS in a very prompt manner. If things don't work at the level of the OPOC and the registered name holder, then the registrar could essentially make available information that would then be the basis for what would normally occur in the absence of the OPOC system. That's at a minimum.
Yeah, that's the reveal function, if you will.
Yeah, if, for example, for some reason there wasn't a reveal that could be implemented at the level of the registrar, then you'd have to have stronger actions that could be taken by the registrar in certain cases. But perhaps, you know, it's useful to think of a registrar, other than taking on new responsibilities for reveal things, they're doing what they would otherwise do now.
Okay, so one option would be to say that the remedy, on the remedy phase, or the registrar's responsibility to remedy is the same as it is now. It's the status quo, which I think is they have the right to take these steps, but in many cases they don't have an obligation to take these steps. And so again, the question is, do we want, is there another alternative, or do we simply just want to flag this issue and say that there, it'd be worth discussing whether there is any, there are other circumstances in which the registrar should be obligated to do more than they are obligated to do now in this area. Because of the, again, we're just looking at the OPOC system here. Obviously, one thing that happens with the OPOC, with a failure of the OPOC, is that there's some delay. There's another step that you have to go through, another hoop you have to jump through, and that means if you have to go to the OPOC first, then you're delayed in going to the registrar. And if the OPOC fails, if we take a situation, and we haven't really fleshed this out, where a remedy is required and the OPOC fails to deliver it, are we in a situation where the registrar should be required to deliver it? Because the introduction of the OPOC has delayed getting to that point.
This is Steve. Can I get in the queue?
Yeah, go ahead. Steve, does anybody else want to get in the queue?
Adam.
Okay. Anybody else? Go ahead, Steve.
Steve, I really believe you've hit the nail on the head in that the introduction of the OPOC under the guise of creating privacy is a very effective tool for a bad actor to create delay. They might desire to create obscurity, but they get delay for free. And a delay can benefit them in the case of, commercially, in the case of copyright or trademark infringement. It can benefit them in a criminal way with respect to fraud or phishing. And with a denial of service attack, a delay may be all they needed, which was the opportunity to create a denial of service attack or some sort of an attack. And when the attack is over, the damage is done, and it really doesn't matter what's revealed. So delay creates the opportunity for criminal conduct and financial gain that's in violation of ICANN policies. So the delay introduced by the OPOC can't be given away for free. There must be something that is given up for the opportunity to delay. And I think that creates the rationale for more active remedy to be required. And the only person we can seem to impose that remedy on is the registrar. So we have to create a rationale for asking a registrar, requiring a registrar, to take remedy action if the OPOC has failed and simply created a delay.
Okay. Adam, you're in the queue.
Yeah, just that's basically what I was primarily going to say, that you know, it's hard to sort of, it's like there might be different responsibilities because of the fact that we are taking away you know, elements of remedies that third parties would have otherwise. You know, although I am a little reluctant on the idea that was floated several meetings ago about, I guess the question was, is there a point at which the either initially or if it fails to do anything, the OPOC is in some way liable for the site content, the premise being, just to sort of recap, that the current situation where a proxy service puts itself in as the name of the registrant or the registered name holder, under the RAA, that person is deemed to be the owner, and there might be consequences under national law of someone who's the owner of a domain name at which illegal activity is going on. So I'm not sure that it's, you know, it's all the way out of bounds, but to some degree, we are taking what currently is a question of national law, the question being, is there liability for content for someone who claims that they are the owner of the domain, you know, even if they're not actually responsible for that content, and codifying it into the contract. But then, you know, but then again, part of the question is that necessary because of the fact that we are deliberately replacing the proxy with someone who is affirmatively allowed not to say that they are the owner. You know, so I don't know. I could see possibly there being some sort of a safe harbor where the OPOC keeps itself in good graces, whatever those might mean, by fulfilling its obligation. And if it totally falls down on the job, then maybe there's some sort of a safe harbor that it loses, although I'm not exactly sure how to exactly how to phrase what the consequence would be. But, you know, I think, and just one other point, and that is to follow up on the point of talking about, you know, do we treat things differently in terms of intellectual property infringement versus, you know, consumer fraud. You know, that's a real sort of fuzzy line, I think, because, you know, to some degree, intellectual property is, particularly in the copyright and patent cases, you know, is meant as property, a monopolistic right that's given to the property owner to incentivize them to create more. In the trademark context, however, you know, the whole rationale behind trademark laws worldwide is that, you know, that there are rights that are given to the trademark owner in order to keep the consumer from being confused. I mean, the whole thing is a consumer protection rationale, and if the whole point is to prevent consumers from being defrauded and confused, then, you know, that doesn't look very different from the law enforcement rationale, and frankly, it's just taking work off of what the police might do if they had more resources. So, you know, it's hard for me to make such a clean distinction between the two.
Okay. Well, and certainly a lot of the fraud cases involve trademark problems too, if you think about the phishing situation. Well, I think you've introduced a new element here, which is that one way of enforcing the obligations of the OPOC might be exposing them to greater liability if they don't perform them. And I think you've also put your finger on one of the murky areas here, which is, of course, ICANN can't create that liability. That's a matter of national law. we have, for example, in the RAA with proxies, to say that, you know, the licensor of a domain name who fails to reveal the contact information of the licensee when presented with reasonable evidence of actionable harm may be liable for the content or may be liable for the actions of the licensee. It says that in the RAA. That doesn't necessarily mean that a court in a particular case under national law would follow that. But I suppose one thing you could do is put a similar provision in whatever agreement there is between ICANN and the OPAC, if there is one. And that might evidently be an incentive for them to perform, and I suppose a method of enforcement if they don't perform.
Steve, this is Steve DelBianco. That's the first time I've heard a suggestion that ICANN have any relationship at all with an OPAC.
Well, we talked about that last time, about what the relationship would be and whether there would be accreditation. We haven't really resolved that, but there is some a sense that that might be beneficial. Now, that would be needed for what Adam is talking about. It wouldn't necessarily be needed for the other types of enforcement we've been talking about here, which all devolve to the registrar, which already has a contractual relationship.
This is Chris.
Chris, go ahead.
Okay, I wanted to, you know, agree with this point that it can be very fuzzy, the distinction between cases of fraud and intellectual property issues. I think that it's hard to come up with some categorical approach that would divide those two and say we have a different approach with respect to one versus the other. And I think one thing that's therefore important when we think about these is that we're looking at three actors in this system. There's the registered name holder, there's the OPAC, and there's the registrar. And I think it's important that each of those, obviously the registered name holder will have this, but that the OPAC and the registrar have the authorization to take these various steps. And that point in itself should be made clear, and it can happen through the chain of contracts. So that means the OPAC should have the authorization to take action with respect to the name. It may be merely reveal, or it may be to agree with someone who's inquiring that it should be put on hold and therefore to direct the registrar to do so. And then at the level of the registrar, that entity too should have the authorization within its contract that it has the rights to reveal and also to take certain actions. And then it may be impossible for us to spell out all of those various cases of what might be the type of action that would justify an approach in one case versus a different, but if each of those parties has that contractual authorization, then the OPAC itself, for example, if it's an OPAC that's properly performing its role, a third party, and they're receiving these notifications, and the registered name holder, let's say it's a case of fraud, I would think in many cases that party is going to disappear into the ether. They're simply not going to respond. Now the OPAC should be in position to take the requisite action, and it may be something much more than reveal. It may be that they then direct the registrar to take all actions necessary to make this go black. And if it's a responsible OPAC, they should have that ability to do so. And of course, if the OPAC is in default under their responsibilities, then you go to the registrar and you make your case to the registrar, and they should have the same. So as a common matter, all three parties should have that full authorization to take all responsible steps.
Right. Okay. We're running a little low on time here. It's about 6 minutes before the hour. So let me just see if there's anything else that people want to bring up about HAL. I think we've had a good discussion here and a good focusing of these issues. So let me ask first is if anybody else wants to be heard on the HAL questions.
Okay, Steve, I'll be done in a
Steve, it's Adam.
Yeah. Go ahead.
One other sort of aspect, this may be a little bit tangential, is to, I think we've kind of talked about what happens on the particular domain names case with respect to if the OPAC isn't doing its job. From a systemic point of view, there might be, we might want to, and this may be sort of a no-brainer, but if we're under a situation where there's accreditation, in order to get a contract that ICANN can have with the OPAC, because that's really the only way we can dictate uniform responsibilities. I mean, we can talk about the reveal and so forth and what happens if the OPOC doesn't fulfill its responsibilities, but the question still arises, how do we impose those responsibilities in the first instance? And that, I think, has to be, and I haven't heard any other suggestion as to how else we would do that. That has to be by virtue of some sort of contractual link to ICANN, and it seems like our discussion of a few calls ago about accreditation is the only suggestion I've heard about how to do that. From a systemic point of view, yes, if, you know, I have a complaint with regard to a specific domain name and the OPOC doesn't do their thing, then maybe the information for that domain name gets revealed. It might be a no-brainer, but I would imagine that at some point the OPOC should lose its accreditation and should not be able to be an OPOC anymore, you know, because otherwise they're going to be a serial violator. And maybe that's a no-brainer, but just thought it's worth mentioning.
Okay, thank you. All right.
Steve, this is Chris. One real quick thing. On the first point, which was your number one on the improper OPOC violation,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's something that I had fleshed out in the draft proposal I put in to some degree, and I just wanted to highlight that, you know, the idea is that if subgroup C decides that, for example, the system, well, one of the alternatives in their report is that legal versus natural person could be based on a self-declaration. That's something that's debated within that group. And commercial versus non-commercial activity could also be based on a self-declaration made by the registered name holder at the time of registration. So the idea here is that if people self-declare improperly, you know, they don't state what is factually accurate, then there'd be a lightweight procedure to challenge that OPOC type of registration.
Okay. We'll incorporate that. All right. If there's nothing further on how, let me just, there are really two more things we need to do here. One, I think Steve wanted us to look back again at this when question, and if we could, we've talked about some different time frames and so forth, but I'm not sure that whether we're in a position to actually come up with time frames within which the relay, the reveal, or the remedy would happen. But let me open the floor to any comments on those questions, which are really, I think it's kind of spelled out on page 3 of the discussion outline.
Steve, this is Steve Del Bianco. With respect to what we turn over to the full task force, it's clear we'll be able to raise these great questions, but there are some cases where we would suggest consensus answers, in some cases where we'd suggest potential answers that weren't able to achieve consensus.
Are you talking just about the when page or in general here?
In general.
Okay.
And with respect to the when page, we ought to structure what we convey as these are the questions we dealt with under the when, and there are instances where we did have solid answers and instances
okay,
where we didn't.
What are our solid answers then? I mean, I think one was that the relay would be immediate in all cases to which relay applies.
Agreed.
At least if it's email.
At least if it's email, yeah.
In which case we take the question mark sort of off of there, or we go ahead and answer it.
Right.
Okay.
This is Chris.
Yes.
I think on the timing, I think you want to at least list some different examples. And some of the different time frames that have been suggested by various measures. You could imagine there are certain types of activity that would require very immediate response and others that might not be so pressing. I don't know if we'd reach consensus on those various types, but at least to list them out as some different examples that might be helpful.
But on the other hand, we've also heard that it's not always easy to draw a distinction between, let's say, a fraud situation and an intellectual property situation or just a trademark situation. So
right.
But with respect to relay under when, the first part of the relay, the first leg of the relay, we think should be immediate.
Yeah.
And that is to relay to the registered name holder. Do we also need to say what are the when obligations on relaying the second leg, getting back from the registered name holder and relaying their response to the question if there was a question posed by the complainant?
That would be immediate. So.
Well, perhaps immediately upon receiving the second leg of the relay from the registered name holder, but...
Yeah, but remember, the OPOC is supposed to be there 24-7 and has these capabilities. The registrant could be, you could have a wide range of capabilities. I mean, and at this point, there aren't any capability requirements to be a registrant.
Yeah, but you know, whenever the registrant sends that communication back, then it happens. It gets back to the complainant immediately.
Okay, but I think Steve is raising a different question, which and we've talked about already in enforcement. How do you know if relay isn't working? You send your complaint in. Let's assume you get a BCC or something like that that says the OPOC has relayed it to the registered name holder. You're notified of that in some way. Then nothing happens. So is there, obviously before you can go to the next step, which I think we said would be the reveal function, asking for reveal, there would have to be some type of time limit there or time limits, depending on the type of case. I think Eric had made a suggestion earlier on our call about 48 hours to 5 days. I'm not sure if that was exactly which cases that was intended to cover.
This is Eric. Yeah, the 48 hours would be the time in which the OPOC has to notify the registrant, and the 5 days would be the registrant's response. If you go any faster than 5 days, you're really kind of outside the scope of historic protocol. You know, 5 days for mailing, 10 days for response is usually legal type of documentation. So if we're doing it on the QT 724, 48 and 5 seems very reasonable to me.
Okay,
reasonable, but this is Steve, but it is 5 days longer than the status quo of me learning who is the registrant.
Theoretically, the OPOC would make it within 2 or 3 hours of getting it, and he'd be back to you within 2 or 3 hours. There's no time limit now on when someone has to respond to a query other than through UDRP.
True enough, but with its status quo, with an open and accurate who is, a complainant knows who the registrant is, and there isn't any need for relay function. There's simply a communication directly to the registrant. We're introducing a delay at even learning who the registrant is, not just the delay at getting a response from the registrant.
And there's also no time limit on the complainant, armed with the information about who the registrant is, exercising their legal rights.
Well, are you suggesting there should be?
No, I'm just seconding Steve's point that this system introduces the delay before the complainant can exercise its legal rights. As Eric said, there's no obligation for the registered name holder to get back, but there's also no obligation for the complainant to wait for them to get back before taking legal action, but this system introduces a new delay before they effectively can do that because they don't know who the registrant is.
Okay, but then we have this problem of, again, when is it ripe? Again, it's a relay situation. Let's stipulate it's not a, you know, life or death or immediate action type situation. Leave aside what that might be. You ask for the relay happens, you just don't hear anything back from the registrant. At what point can you go to the OPOC and say, well, now you have to reveal?
This is Steve. I would say that the OPOC should be expected to use some level of reasonable action to follow up with his client, the registrant, to say, did you not get this email? Try alternative ways of reaching them, and to say, we need to get these guys an answer. I mean, in a perfect world, the OPOC is saying, we need to get these guys an answer. And the time it takes for them to answer either on behalf of, because remember, they may have an agency relationship, successful event, they can't answer on behalf of the registrant. So I don't think we have to go with 5 days. I'd like to see it be shorter than that.
Well, it could be shorter, I suppose. You know, they could agree with the registrant that it would be shorter, but we need to try to, if this system is going to work, I think at some point we need to define minimums. And OPOC will be in default if he doesn't reveal after he's done a relay and there's been no answer for 5 days. That's one way you could establish a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
But I hear you that it is, yes, this is, compared to status quo, this is an element of delay.
And there was no element of delay created. There was no element of delay as a motivation for us to create the OPOC scheme. The OPOC scheme is created for the sole reason of privacy.
Right. Okay, any further comments on this question? I mean, Eric, what do you think about those arguments?
This is Eric. I don't think the 48-hour return is a bad idea, and the reason for that is this. I've been around doing this long enough to watch guys run into court in about 2 hours with papers and get a court order, and certainly that would override anything we're doing. So if there's something really critical time-sensitive, then the complainant is going to be able to do something much quicker than what we're allowing for here. We're certainly not stopping legal process. Oh, I'm sorry. That brought me back to the fraud versus just mistaken.
Yeah.
And that's really important. And it's not just fraud. It's what we, you know, negligent versus intentional. So we start getting into dividing that up and deciding which one's which. Whew! It's a lot of work.
Yeah, it gets complicated very quickly. Okay, well, I'm not sure that we have agreement on this, but we have, I guess there's two schools of thought. One is that we should have a definite time minimum within which a reveal, after which a reveal would be appropriate. Others that maybe need to be more fluid depending on the type of incident involved. I mean, a lot of this does focus our attention on which are the relay situations, which are the immediate reveal situations. Which are the situations where you can go to the OPOC and say, "Well, give me the registered name holder's data now," which we haven't clearly defined. But I think the example that Chris asked that we list some examples, and I think we could certainly try to do that. Okay,
Steve, Adam, for a process question.
Yes.
Where do we go from here? Your document raises a lot of questions, and I think that there are a lot of cases where we've actually been able to.
I think so. Yeah, I think
to answer them, but those answers aren't really indicated here. Where do we go from here?
I guess what I would suggest is that I circulate a new version of this that tries to indicate where we have some agreement among the participants. And where I don't have question marks, I think that's. That is generally an area of agreement, but let me try to walk through that and see if people agree with where I've indicated agreement. And then I think there are a few areas where we don't have agreement, and we have sort of differing views, and maybe some alternatives. And I'm sure there'll be some things that still need to be fleshed out. But I think we made a lot of progress today on the how questions, as far as the role of the registrar. I think that all can be reflected in the document. So what I would suggest is that I try to circulate something probably, hopefully by the end of the day tomorrow, and I will ask people to give feedback on the list, on our mailing list or directly to Steve, but preferably on the list, as to what their views are on that, whether I've characterized things accurately, whether I've characterized the areas of agreement accurately. And as I said, I think we should, in effect, staple to this Chris's proposal and Steve's proposal, because I think that does provide some more, it kind of fleshes out some of the areas somewhat more.
Steve, if I may respond to that?
Yeah.
This is Steve speaking. With respect to the proposal that I put in, I believe that it has the potential to splinter the discussion with the whole task force if it's attached as an alternative plan. My recommendation would be to extract from my document any answers to the who, what, when, and how, fit them into the context of your document so that we would note under when, for instance, that I have indicated 12 hours of receipt for forwarding, and put that in under the answer where it shows up under the when relay,
yeah,
rather than a fork in the road, because two separate documents stapled together sort of begs the question of which is it are we recommending.
Right.
This is Chris, and it had been my understanding that, for example, Steve would be putting forward what might be considered some form of summary document for the group, and he'd simply be suggesting that there were a couple of proposals received, and these are attached as annexes, but the summary document is called the summary document, and it's, you know, that would be, I think people could distinguish between that and the annexes that are attached.
Particularly if you take information from those proposals where we think that there's been agreement.
Absolutely.
And paste them in here as answers so that this document here is self-contained and contains everything that you need to know about what we agreed, and then there are sort of annexes about kind of it's they serve as source materials. You don't necessarily need to go to them to know what we've agreed on and what are cases where we've identified a couple of different possibilities.
Okay.
This is Chris. I just wanted to go back to the one more time, because as I've listened to all of the various discussion in the last few minutes, I was thinking, you know, one way to approach it would be to have a non-exhaustive list of different examples and the type of time frames that would be contemplated. What I would want to avoid would be an OPAC hiding behind something that somehow gets involved or included in a contract that says, oh, we only have to come back to you within 5 days or 48 hours when the particular instance that's being being brought before the OPAC requires much more immediate action. So, you know, having something like a non-exhaustive list of different time frames would be there as a framework, but, you know, it would still, someone in the system wouldn't be able to hide behind some sort of time frame in disrupting and delaying something that could that should take place much faster.
Chris, would you like to circulate a non-exhaustive list of examples of time frames?
I can try to come up with 4 or 5 and then see what people think of it, because the more I think of it, if everybody in the system, as I said earlier, has authorization to take appropriate action, then, you know, you'd have almost like, you know, I think from the UDLP, there's a non-existent list of bad faith, but there could be other things. In a very different context, you have a non-exhaustive list of different time frames, which is guiding, but parties have the authorization to do what's needed under the particular circumstances that would be presented in a particular case.
Okay, well, I think I've got marching orders here. I would welcome any further input people have, and I will try to get something out tomorrow evening for your review, and hopefully we will have something that we can submit to the full group next Wednesday. Any last observations to make?
Just thank you for putting all your extra time in and leading this. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks.
Seconded.
Thanks to everybody for all of their input. I think we've had some very good discussion here, and hopefully our document will reflect that. Okay. Thanks, everyone, and we'll please look for this in the next couple of days.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.